Honk, honk. This would be easier if the Academy Awards honored comedy equally. In honor of the Pirates, in honor of Pirates of the Caribbean, Dead Men Tell No Tales, what's the most regrettable performance by an Oscar winner?
I'm Kitty Rich, and I'm going with Gwyneth Paltrow in Shallow Hal. And yes, that movie did come out after she won her Oscar.
Hey, it's me, David the Seven, and I'm going with Marlon Brando in the You Rock My World Michael Jackson video.
I am Matt Patches, and there are many better examples than this, but I want to throw some shade here and just say Charlize Theron, who won her Oscar for Monster and recently started Fate of the Furious. Fuck that movie.
Wow. Wow.
Worst
and I'm
use
David
of Charlize
Ehrlich.
Theron ever.
And I haven't seen it, but everybody in Thor Ragnarok is unworthy of that movie. Is that, right? That's what it'd say?
Was that? Oh, that's your David impression. I thought you were doing Vin Diesel coming at me over Charlize Theron. Hey,
maybe that's what I was doing.
Gotta stick up for family.
You could don't hurt my child. Now hey, it's like wait. Sylvester Stallone.
Anthony hey. Hopkins is still not.
Adrian! Charlize.
I was looking up the Thor cast to see if there were any Oscar winners in it. I thought Anthony Hopkins died.
Gentlemen, you can't fight in here. This is the war room.
Fine, I can hear you now, Dimitri. Clear and plain and coming through fine. I'm coming through fine too, eh? Good. Then, as you say, we're both coming through fine. Good. Well, it's good that you're fine and I'm fine. I agree with you. It's great to be fine.
It's a podcast. Hello and welcome to Fighting in the War Room. It's episode 167 and it's Tuesday, May 16th. And on this day, Dave has picked a very can-friendly on this day in history, which is where David is. On this day in 1997, Pulp Fiction won the Palme d'Or at the 47th Annual Cannes Film Festival. In
1997.
Wait, it can't have been the 47th Annual Cannes because this year is the 70th. Anyway.
Well, then let's just pretend numbers
I was just going to comment on how long ago 97 was, and then I realized that I can count. Anyway.
Wait, it definitely did not happen in 1997.
Oh, yeah. It totally didn't.
I think that would be
in
one of the major problems here.
Oh, yeah. That would be, you know what? Who knows what happened today?
Pulp Fiction was delayed many years in order to win the 1997 Palme d'Or.
And also, it's May 23rd? This is all wrong.
Wow.
What happened to you? We're
alternate histories. Someone went back
in time
to change it so that we could give Pulp Fiction the Palme d'Or.
On this
anyway.
Day in history, Doctor Who flew in his TARDIS and changed history forever.
we'll have to explain to you later in our long delayed third season why there are minor inconsistencies in our storyline.
Yeah, we have a whole theory, a fan theory that makes up for this flub, but yep. It's all intentional.
Yeah, go to Reddit, learn all about it. David's at Cannes, so we're going to make up Cannes facts just to annoy him, even though he'll never listen to this. But thank you for listening, and thank you for leaving your reviews. Do we have any reviews?
We do.
Hooray.
Should I read them? I'm looking
Please.
At them here. All right.
Good.
We have three reviews. They're very nice. So thank for people for leaving them. The first one is Sci-Fi Dying? By A24 Is My Spirit Animal. Sincerely hoping you talk about King Arthur, the magnum opus of Guy Ritchie's reimagined his stories. The fact that this cinematic adventure got beat out by a joke stealer and oldie hon is disheartening. Good pun. Sad. Will we eventually stop seeing bold takes on storytelling and be left with boring, safe movies? We need more sci-fi movies and more new ideas, and it seems the environment for this is caustic right now. All of this, of course, exempt to Marvel movies, but they can literally put out 2 hours of hot garbage and people will go see it. Ready Player One appreciation post. Wow. Who thinks sci-fi is dying? There's so much.
I mean, well, so at what step is it not original sci-fi, which might be something that we'll talk about later on in this episode. But if you told me that the Transformers had been around since the time of the Knights, I would say, explain that, good sir.
And then Michael Bay would in IMAX,
mm-hmm.
3D.
In the fifth installment of something.
I'm not exactly sure how that King Arthur tied into the whole review here. I'm sorry that we didn't talk about it. The short answer is, it's fine. It's fine. There are giant elephants. But that's not a science fiction movie. So I'm jumbled. I'm schizophrenic when it comes to this review. But thank you for leaving it. We appreciate it. The next review is from Jake Lusk. Subject is, for a bunch of liberal millennials, this is a great podcast. Just discovered this podcast a couple weeks ago, and I'm hooked. You kids sure do see a lot of movies. It's so good that I've stopped watching Fox News 24 hours a day. I haven't seen Bill O'Reilly in almost 3 weeks, which is saying a lot. Ask my family. Oof. Oof is me. Now I'm not usually interested in the opinions of what I can only presume are a bunch of millennial snowflake liberals, but these four have somehow managed to hold my interest as they unleash their unique and delicious blend of pop culture commentary every week. They are so good, I'm starting to think Trump might have been a bad thing for this country. However, one criticism. Why have you not reviewed any Christian movies, such as Saving Christmas, the Kirk Cameron masterpiece, Fireproof, another classic masterpiece with the great Kirk Cameron in it, or Christian Mingle, a surprisingly clever romantic comedy about dating and finding the ultimate Mr. Right? Are you guys saving those for some special Christian movie episode? P.S. I have a serious question for each of you. If you could pick a movie that has not yet been released by Criterion Collection, which would it be? My pick is Hal Ashby's Shampoo, although there are like 100 options that come to mind. Love the podcast. Sincerely, J.Lew. Whew!
So yeah, both of these reviews, I'm unclear on which parts are supposed to be read sarcastically.
I know. We need the sarcastic markers. We need the punctuation. I think the Fox News thing was a joke. I can't tell.
I mean, I don't know. I don't want to be gotcha'd by somebody, but taking that on face value, like the wide-eyed, innocent child that I am, I'm glad that he enjoys this podcast.
I mean, we've had conservative listeners chime in and say that we talk too much about politics and we're too in a bubble. So it's not out of the realm of possibility that we would be called snowflake liberals. I mean, we are snowflake liberals.
I'd do a Kirk Cameron, the oeuvre of Kirk Cameron episode at some point if we run out of ideas.
Run out of ideas? It's number one. If you want my thought on Christian movies, I basically align with the Thrillist stance. So go there. I'm going to plug that. Oh, wait, we should answer this question. What movie needs to be on the Criterion Collection? Now that David's not here and starts listing all of them.
Oh, God. That requires me to know what's on the Criterion Collection.
Groundhog Day, of course.
Oh. Titanic? Is it on the Criterion Collection?
It's definitely not. But it should be.
It should be.
All good movies should be on the Criterion Collection, I think, is the
I mean, anything
consensus.
Visually impressive?
I want something like old. Like I'm trying to Google to make sure I'm not like
is the
stupid.
Searchers on Criterion? That'd be a good one.
Oh, what about Freaks?
Preserve Freaks. Actually, I'm
I want to preserve something old with my Criterion.
Criterion.
Oh, that's good too.
Flamingos on Blu-ray so badly. That is my latest search. I guess it's not issued. Sad.
Yeah.
One more review. Good podcast with interesting takes. 5 stars from BA3311. This podcast is great if you are looking for different takes on current movies, TV shows, and pop culture. Every host brings a different perspective. I like all of them, except David. Doesn't like any Marvel movies, and overall has different interests in movies than myself. Joanna Robinson is sometimes a guest, so be warned, those episodes will have a strong feminist opinion, which could not be your thing
be
overall.
Warned.
Worth checking out the titles to see if it is a topic you would be interested in. Dave, that is not a sarcastic review. That is a positive.
Well, see, I think we threw all this mud into the water by joking about it last week about like funny reviews, and now we're floating in the ether here. But I'm into it.
I mean, we have a strong feminist opinion here across the board, I would say.
It's true.
But I mean, be warned.
Be warned that we do. Unless you just want to listen to the topics you're interested in, which we put in the website and on iTunes. You can read all about them. Something, something. Leave more reviews. No matter where on the political spectrum or social spectrum that you fall. Katie, are we missing anything?
About our views on the social spectrum?
Yes.
I mean, if you're not here for strong feminist point of views, maybe think about why you're not a feminist.
Yeah. There's a podcast out there.
Yeah. Anyway, thank you all for your reviews, whether or not you support feminism. Please keep leaving them. We appreciate them. And David will read them all and maybe read them in an accent or make fun of your name when he comes back.
Any of them! You fucking pricks, move! And I'll execute every motherfucking last one of you!
TV grab bag.
Wait, sing that song, Dave.
Summer TV grab bag. It's not the normal season, but people put lots of money into it now that we can time shift everything. But everyone still does their shit on a Sunday. Sometimes there is streaming, like the third season of Kimmy Schmidt, or the second season of Master of None, or God knows 50 other things. Please, Netflix, stop. I need a life.
Refrain. No. This was going to be a segment about television, but I really enjoy this song. As Dave has hinted, we were just going to fly through a bunch of TV gut reactions, first reactions, because not only is there a ton of TV in the last month, and apologies to the people who want us to be covering The Leftovers. I don't know about you guys, I'm just trying to catch up on that. I am not up to date, even though Twitter is full of positive reactions every Sunday. And I'm not caught up on Master of None. You guys?
I watched two.
Oh, you've seen the black and white episodes.
It's just the first one, isn't it?
I don't know. I haven't watched it yet.
Oh, you haven't watched it?
Yeah.
But you've seen the first, so you've seen his Italy trip, Aziz Ansari.
Yeah, no, the first episode is like very much a Bicycle Thief riff, and it's in black and white and, you know, filmed in, not in Rome, but in this small town in Italy. And it's, you know, I thought it was a really excellent like riff on a classic film that if you've seen it, you get it. And if you haven't, you kind of get that it's like a vague Italian film reference. And it's still a really good show that is worth watching, even if you're not getting their like high-minded film stuff.
What about the second episode? It's totally different, right? Like they're each basically
the second episode is still in Italy. So, but it's much more just like a regular Master of None episode. You have Eric Wareheim shows up, who plays his friend. You watched the first season, right, Patches?
I did, and loved
you're,
it.
And you're a Tim and Eric fan, so having Eric Wareheim back was surely a pleasure. And they kind of have their little adventure in the town in Italy where he is.
Well, I'm waiting to see if Paro the Seal shows up again in season two, and if he doesn't, I'll be somewhat disappointed. But
I don't know.
No spoilers.
I don't know. No sign of the seal yet.
So, what, Katie, your short description of Master of None, your gut reaction is basically what I want to fly through here in a few. For a few shows, because, again, we're so overloaded. But, this weekend was the premiere of Twin Peaks, the long-anticipated return of David Lynch's... It was an ABC show, hour-long drama, and now it is on Showtime, where it can really be weirder, I would say, based on the first 2 hours. Now, there were three available, or four available, to watch on Showtime anytime, the streaming service, but I've seen the first two. Katie, I think you've seen the first two. Dave, have you... seen?
I'm almost done with the fourth one.
Oh, okay. Whoa. So you'll be able to jump ahead here. But
should you though? I really can't decide what the spoiler policy is for the third and fourth episode.
Impossible. Even if I were to try to explain to you what it was.
I guess not spoilers as much as like let me form my own opinion, but I don't know. It's a safe space.
I will say that even though the first two episodes are a part one, part two called The Return, that consistent flow keeps going, so it feels like it's going to be an 18-hour continuous experience. I'm not seeing a whole bunch of grouping by like theme or anything like that that you'd expect from other like prestige TV shows. It's really just jumping around Twin Peaks. I'm not exactly sure if there is like going to be a central mystery as much as I maybe thought after the first two episodes. So it's interesting.
Well, so
yeah,
Dave,
definitely,
you just watched...
in the first two episodes, you definitely feel like Matthew Lillard is somehow going to be like maybe the mystery unifying the whole season.
Right. And then episode three doesn't go back to that plot line at all.
What about, I mean, in the Black Lodge, in the kind of red room that they're in, at the end of two, they talk about, you know, that they're something, are they in the future or the past and something is wrong? I mean, there's a lot of... This is the theme of Twin Peaks, right? Lots of vague lines about that seem mysterious, that kind of go nowhere, mostly because the show got cut off or kind of fizzled out in 1991 with the second season. But Dave, you just watched the whole thing. What's your general reaction? I mean, even if you don't think there's a prevailing mystery to all this, there is sure a lot of mysterious stuff. I mean, the first episode, there's this guy that I don't think we've ever met before, and I'm not sure we know how he's tied into the grand Twin Peaks mythos, but he's sitting in a New York City apartment watching a translucent box being filmed, and eventually he sees some sort of spirit entity as he's making out with his girlfriend. He's all cut up. It's just a crazy, crazy scene. I don't know what it really means. I'm not sure I need to know what it means, but I had a great visceral reaction to it. And I'm wondering if you, having just binged the original two seasons, if you feel that way.
Yeah, I'm loving the direction that it's going in. And I think that the first 2 hours being presented together was a great way to show people that the concept has aged along with us. I still feel like it's very Twin Peaks, but then episodes 3 and 4 start pushing out into David Lynch being back in crazy creative territory. I think the first 15 minutes of episode 3 take place entirely in the Red Room or wherever Cooper is at the end of, after he's in the box for a brief period of time. The reason I stopped and didn't finish episode 4 is I was doing it while I was like, you know, reading something else. And I realized that I was, you know, applying this binge thing to something that I actually want to sit down and allow, you know, the sequences that are supposed to be long to play out as they're supposed to be for me as a viewer. So I actually stopped myself from just wanting to know things to I have to go back and like re-steep in the episodes that I've already seen.
Yeah, I'm not really sure what they're trying to do with the 3rd and 4th episodes being available, because I feel like I had the same problem. Like, I was trying to just catch up so I knew what was going on and then realized I was not really serving anyone by doing that.
I don't think they're doing it for story purposes. It feels like a tactic to create a kind of binge conversation, be part of the Netflix phenomenon without actually giving it all out.
But there's 18 episodes. Like, they're going to be on for so long for a
series. Well, is it supposed to run as a single season, or is it going to come back in a year? Is it a few episodes?
I think they're saying it's a limited series, and so it's all just going. Like,
according to Showtime, the last episode airs in September. So this is just going to be happening every Sunday.
Wow.
This is going to kill Joanna Robinson, who's going to like recap this and Game of Thrones.
But maybe this
and
is
American Gods.
I mean, do you have to recap it every Sunday? You're putting a bunch of episodes up, so some people, there's so much TV, people can binge it in one setting. They don't have to tune in every Sunday. They can come every month and watch a handful of episodes and then the rest play. I mean, that's kind of
a
meta conversation.
I have a hard time imagining a lot of people following this. Like, obviously, film Twitter was really excited, and people who were really into the... I really like the original Twin Peaks. I really like David Lynch, so I definitely have... I mean, the arm, the, like, tree with the big, like, blob
Holy
on top
crap.
Of the talk is, like, my favorite thing. But if you liked, like, the stories of Twin Peaks and the characters, like, I can definitely see someone tuning into this and being like, this is the thing that TV's into. Oh, this is definitely not for me.
Well, this feels like... I don't really know enough about this, and I'm trying to learn much, much more because I'm interested, but someone mentioned that they thought this season of Twin Peaks feels more like Mulholland Drive and perhaps has more to do with the show that he conceived to do after Twin Peaks and more in that, even more expressionistic vibe. Again, the smattering of images. But for me, knowing that David Lynch is obsessed with transcendental meditation and kind of dream images and... like just channeling the back of his brain and letting it all spill out. I think this show is very much about transcendental meditation, letting go, disconnecting from reality. And I'd be interested to see if that's the resolve. If it's not really about the mystery so much as like Cooper detaching from mystery or detaching from the people he knew or the world of Twin Peaks or solving the crime, the death of Laura Palmer, if it's about this kind of like religious meditation act. And I don't know. I don't think it needs to.
See, I think you're going to be asking different questions after each episode that you see that like gets added on top of the pile. So what we think it is, I think, is going to change every time we get to see a little peek behind the curtain.
I mean, I just love having all this weird crap thrown at the screen, and each scene was so visceral watching those two back-to-back on the premiere night. I just thought it was awesome.
No, I mean, there's a reason that David Lynch gets away with showing you completely weird, inscrutable shit, and people love Mulholland Drive and don't understand it at all. He's better at it than anybody else, and you have someone do that, and you're watching something in your home on a Sunday night that you don't understand, and you actually want to keep up with it. It's a total pleasure. But
it's such a different reaction to, like, Legion. Did you watch any of Legion, Katie?
No, I watched 15 minutes and hated it. And turned
yeah, but it's Legion was kind of playing with the same, like, you never know what's really going on, at least in the pilot. And Noah Hawley, to me, I mean, I shouldn't position creators against each other like this. It's a reductive act. But I couldn't help but think of Noah Hawley during this show. And
the first episode, all the
kind of manufactured mystery.
Very Fargo-y.
The first episode of Twin Peaks.
All the stuff with Matthew Lillard. Like, all those scenes feel a lot like
calling that Fargo-y. It's the reverse.
No, I get it.
Could be Twin Peaks.
Kind of. I mean, like, Twin Peaks was so much more like a soap opera than any of this stuff. Anyway, Noah Hawley obviously is inspired by David Lynch.
He's biting his fingernails. Dave, any last thoughts on Twin Peaks? We'll definitely come back to this because David is a huge fan, and we'll, once we're in deep, we'll have more to talk about. But gut reaction.
I'm excited for being as deep in as I am and still not disliking anything. Like, I thought they would have at least bucked me a little bit.
Yeah, what
all
part didn't you like,
Katie? With Bob Cooper, with the dark Cooper who's like running around with his long, gross hair. I just don't find it that interesting. I don't think Kyle MacLachlan is that good at playing like a hardcore bad guy. And I saw someone compare him to like Frank Booth in Blue Velvet, which I just don't think holds up. Like, Frank Booth is a much more compelling character. So someone told me he doesn't figure that much into episode 3. So I'm excited to catch that. And maybe good Cooper the Lodge, I'd take that all day.
Although, isn't it supposed to be?
I want to tell you things real bad, but yeah, I shouldn't.
This isn't what Cooper's supposed to be like, right? I mean, he's possessed.
No, Cooper is.
It should be awkward.
I said he's Bob Cooper. He's possessed by Bob. But
yeah.
That's like the most that you see of Kyle MacLachlan in the first two episodes. You know, Cooper in the Lodge is basically just kind of sitting there responding to people, and he's great. Kyle MacLachlan as Cooper is wonderful. But yeah, the kind of like hardcore bad guy who murders people in hotel rooms.
Right.
Give me less of that.
He's at his best
guys.
He's gawking at Laura Palmer, opening up her face
God.
And beaming
so
light.
We're gonna have to do like a 5-minute next week, just after you guys have seen episode 3, because I'm like bursting at the seams trying to like interject. But
wait,
I'm gonna restrain myself.
One more thing on Twin Peaks. I mean, am I the only one who misses kind of the soap opera-y small town saga of the original series? Like, there was a lot. There's a little bit of that in the Matthew Lillard parts of the first two episodes,
and the Hawk stuff.
The stuff with Hawk and the log lady was nice and character driven, but the rest of it, I missed it being in Twin Peaks, the town.
I'll say this, when Naomi Watts pops up, I think she's in that groove. And then when we see Bobby again, I think he's in that groove. So I just think we have to get to the parts of the story that are more soap opery and in that vein. I think we will get there. Yeah, yeah. I think we're not even close to halfway through Act
One. No, we're obviously jumping into this very, very early.
Yeah, okay. I think there's a balance, and it was interesting to choose those two episodes first. I think it worked really well. I'm excited. That's my gut reaction.
To round out our TV grab bag, Katie, you and I watched some Kimmy Schmidt. Dave, did you watch any Kimmy Schmidt?
I did. Also 4 episodes.
Oh,
good time to be 4 episodes into things.
It's a great. Yeah. If 4 episodes is the perfect, you didn't binge the whole thing. You didn't ruin it. You know, you didn't stuff yourself, but you got a little taste. You got a hearty.
That's a lot of TV in one weekend, though.
That is a lot of TV.
Yeah, but, and I did like a Game of Thrones rewatch. It's horrible.
Oh man,
go outside,
you're sagging
Dave.
Your couch.
It was snowing.
You know, as mentioned, Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt came back to Netflix for a third season. And I don't know about you guys, but I absolutely loved the first two seasons of this. Despite it, you know, I think the second season got hit hard by a lot of think pieces, and maybe deservedly so, about how the show talks about its own criticisms against it, about race and social issues, and Tina Fey, Robert Carlock, they make no concessions about taking things to task, whether they seem problematic or not. They're always out to criticize with a joke. And Kimmy Schmidt has been an amazing vehicle for that in the first two seasons. What do you think of the third season? Is it up to snuff for you guys? Is it zany and funny and enjoyable? I always find Kimmy Schmidt to be a total relief. And actually, for me, this season is a little flat. It's a little weird.
Well, I'm actually curious about you now having watched 30 Rock, because for me, Kimmy Schmidt has always kind of sort of approached 30 Rock, but not quite gotten there. It's always been a smaller story that with kind of less surprising directions to go. And maybe now that you've seen 30 Rock, are you comparing it?
Well, for me, Kimmy Schmidt was it never really felt like Tina Fey's show the way 30 Rock did. It felt, oh, what is her husband's
name?
She's
not literally Jeff Richmond.
Jeff Richmond. No, I what I mean, well, yeah, of course 30 Rock is her show because she's also in it, but like it feels like her sense of humor too. And for me, Kimmy Schmidt is a bit more of Jeff Richmond's show, if that makes sense. I know he's an executive producer and the composer on it, and not just because you have Titus who can sing crazy songs and there's a lot of musical elements. It just feels this kind of like jaunty cartoon. The show bounces along to Jeff Richmond's music more than 30 Rock did. And I've always thought about it as his show. And
you're taking the authorship away from the woman and giving it to her husband? Nice move.
Wow. Well, that's not what I meant.
Yeah, good job, Patches.
I'm going to say it before someone tweets at us about it.
Well,
I guess what I'm saying here is that it's Tina Fey's show that she's doing in service of what her husband does, even more than she did in 30 Rock, which I can understand. She had her show, and this feels like this had to be a pivot into something different. But for me, Kimmy Schmidt season 3, I don't know, it's missing that twinkle in its eye. It actually has some amazing musical moments. There's an episode where, Titus goes full Lemonade, which is really funny. Titus is still the very best part of the show. And especially in season 3, as kind of like Kimmy loses her way and she's going to college this season. And none of that really is very fun to me. She's kind of stuck between being a cartoon and being an idiot and being like this real person. And the second season did a really good job of balancing her like relationship issues, this kind of PTSD that she was suffering from. Now she doesn't have anything. I don't feel like she has an issue on the table to be bouncing between real person and cartoon and have that fun dynamic. But so Titus is still the anchor of this show. And again, he does the Lemonade bit. He has an episode where he has to sing really disturbing right-wing songs, and he sings about boobs in Los Angeles, which is the funniest fucking thing I've ever seen. I really liked that, but I don't know. Am I alone here? Is it as good as it was the last two seasons? Katie, it sounds like you think so.
No, I mean, I think it's this as good as, in that it's always like not quite getting there for me. I thought the first episode was like really fine, and then I thought the Lemonade episode was really great, and that they kind of made it emotional. Like, I feel like Kimmy Schmidt has a hard time like having feelings for these characters because its version of New York is just really heightened in a way that it never, like Carol Kane especially, she's really funny, but she doesn't really feel like a person to care about. And I thought the Lemonade episode did that really nicely. But then like it has gags like where Kimmy is touring colleges and David Diggs is giving her a tour, and it's the Robert Moses school, and on the wall it says Robert Moses College for Whites, which is crossed out and then says for everyone, which is so funny. And the vision and the way it's presented is really funny. So it's got just the best jokes, but it just feels like it has a ceiling that 30 Rock never did.
Yeah, it's more relevant, and that makes it more vulnerable.
Like, is it more relevant?
It's a more fragile show. Yeah, I think it's more relevant because 30 Rock lived in this weird bubble of privilege. Like, it made a lot of jokes about social issues, but it was kind of above it all. It had this holier-than-thou mentality, and that was part of the joke, but it didn't seem to confront real issues. And I feel like Kimmy Schmidt has more on its mind, almost it's pressured to in this current age. And sometimes it falters, and sometimes it soars high. Like, there's bits in, I think, the third episode where Kimmy goes to visit Columbia University, and she sees what's that teenage girl? I have never remembered her name. She is so inconsequential to the show. Jay Krasowski's daughter on the show.
She's a great name. It's like not Clementine. It's anyway.
Something. But anyway, she meets her friends at Columbia. Not her friends. These girls hate her because her family name is on the building, and they see her as a result of privilege. And these girls are just all over her about being like gender normative and using certain words. And it's obviously a jab at these girls who are privileged because they're going to Columbia and whatnot. But the message is blurry. I mean, Tina Fey is not putting up with this progressive agenda that's becoming more and more important to dialogue, especially online. But she doesn't seem to be having any of it, or at least she's raising an eyebrow at all of it, which I don't know. Is it caught up? Is it not? Is it problematic?
I think it's more the second one.
Is any of it like better class commentary than like Jack Donaghy saying it's after six when I'm a farmer about wearing a tuxedo? Like I feel like 30 Rock came from a position of privilege, but it did a really good job. It was comfortable in that realm. Tina Fey has been in this world and kind of feels like an outsider in it. And Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt, like the way that it depicts like living in a shitty neighborhood in Greenpoint, it feels a little cartoony, like you were saying about the character of Kimmy herself. Also, the teenage daughter's name is Xanthippe, better than any name I would have. It's so
Dave,
good.
What's your final word on Kimmy Schmidt? Enjoying it?
I mean, you almost talked me into liking it less, but thus far I like it because it's in the groove where it's the characters are comfortable and reacting comfortably. So what you see is like a lack of edge. I see as a bonus in my enjoyment of watching it as a joke factory, or in the case of Kimmy's core characters being sort of absent, just watching Ellie Kemper turn it into a series of moments, sometimes over one delivery, is still enjoyable enough for 20 minutes at a time, I think.
There you go. Kimmy Schmidt on Netflix. And before this TV, really long TV grab bag ends, I must say, if you haven't watched Catastrophe on Amazon, I insist that you do, especially this third season, which it's the best show on television. It really is.
Wow.
Sharon Horgan, Rob Delaney, married couple, just going about life. They both have serious issues. They both have kids together. It's just about life, man, and it is so good. And it gets even better this season because people fuck up miserably in a variety of ways that feel totally relatable. And I don't know, have you guys watched Sharon Horgan's HBO show with Sarah Jessica Parker, Divorce? Or have you brought yourself
to watch
that? No,
I heard enough people who hated it.
Yeah, it's not too enjoyable, and it feels very plastique. Like I it doesn't feel like someone who has really gone through divorce or going through these real human relationships before, and that's the complete opposite of Catastrophe, which feels totally lived in, and you just want to sit in their bedroom as they're talking for like half an hour. I could totally do that, but there's more to the show than that. So
has anyone watched Creepy? As someone who has a kid, is it going to be just triggering?
No, I think you'll like it more. I think
cathartic.
The more you can relate to it, the better, and I think everyone can actually relate to it, whether you have a kid or you're married or not. I mean, I watched the show before I was married, and I'm watching it now after I'm married, and it's sensational.
So as you know, if you've been listening to the show, I have recently moved from New York to Durham, North Carolina, which is home of Duke University, as well as Moog Fest, which is an annual festival Is it Robert Moog, the guy who invented the Moog synthesizer? I believe so. It's inspired by him who created the synthesizer. It is a three-day festival devoted to electronic music and kind of the intersection of music and thought and technology, and it takes a really wide stance on what that can really be. So you get things like concerts from electronic artists like Animal Collective and Flying Lotus, but then Talib Kweli played on the opening night, who I don't think is especially known for his electronic music. There's a lot of conferences about things like building a synthesizer, or I'm kind of pulling up the schedule just to see. Build your own synthesizer for fun, if not for profit. Music, machines, and meaning. Instrument design from analog to digital and back. So there's a lot of like very nerdy stuff that would not really be up my alley at all. But I got to moderate a panel that I got asked to do just basically because I was around and it was easy, and I'm very glad that I did it. And it was these two black women who are electronic music artists called Susie Analog and VHVL. And they both make I'm not even going to have the right language for it because I know so little about music, but they both make wordless electronic music. They're both on Spotify and are worth checking out. And I kind of moderated this conversation between the two of them about being black women artists in electronic music and how interesting and difficult that can be and how people don't expect them to be in that role. And there were all of these different panels throughout about something called African futurism, which I had never even heard of and is this giant kind of... area of thought. What? You've heard of African futurism and I'm just an idiot?
Afrofuturism? Yes, of course. We actually at
all right,
BAM,
how about
while
black
you still live
quantum
here,
futurism?
What was that?
How about black quantum futurism?
I'm not as familiar with the subsection or what falls into that category.
I'm just looking at this. I'm looking at this panel that I did not go to, so I don't know enough about it. But a workshop and discussion exploring the history of linear time constructs, notion of the future, and its contrast to indigenous African traditions of space, time, and the future. It sounds incredible. It's kind of like when you look at a schedule for something like this, and you know, I've been to a bunch of festivals, and I have not taken advantage of things like VR, like the New Frontiers at Sundance, that would kind of expand your thinking about art. But looking at this, it felt like going to college again, like seeing all these different things that were available to you. And this festival descends on this pretty small town of Durham that's also a college town, so it has a lot of spaces that are really equipped for it. And it was just such a pleasure. It was so fun to go to a festival that wasn't Sundance or Cannes or Toronto or the kind of what I considered my usual like routine. And I really can't wait to try to go back next year. And I've been trying to talk Patches into coming and sleeping on my couch. Because
well,
you know
I definitely
way more about
want
all
to
of
come.
This than I do.
I definitely want to come because I hope people of this podcast know that I am a theremin enthusiast.
Indeed.
Have you seen any theremins in action at Moog Fest? Because Moog was...
I saw a Moog theremin, but I don't know that it was actually a theremin. I think it might have just been the name of a different kind of equipment. There were two different workshops on how to build a theremin during Moog Fest, though.
That rules. Yeah, so Moog was one of the first companies to really mainstream, as far as the theremin has been mainstreamed, the instrument, because Robert Moog was obviously inspired by Leon Theremin, the Russian inventor who kind of he was cast out. He was basically banished from Russia, and he had to go live in the United States in the 1930s. And he did a big propaganda tour in Russia before he had to kind of leave. And he did not return to the Soviet Union until the 80s, I think. He didn't go home for 50 years. He couldn't.
Wow.
Because they wanted to use his technology to do horrible things. And he wanted to create these instruments and do amazing things with electronics. So he, you know, played at Carnegie Hall in the United States and he was doing all sorts of things. And he was, you know, when he left, he taught this virtuoso, this theremin virtuoso, Clara Rockmore. And they didn't see each other for decades. They were in love and it's a tragic story. It should be a movie.
Wow.
Leon Theremin,
you know,
and
as good.
And I could go on and on. I love it. But they wanted Soviet Union wanted him to be a spy.
Sadly. Didn't they want him to be a spy? Sorry.
Ben, the producer of the Blank Check podcast, actually has like a good 5 minutes of theremin-based stand-up comedy you should have him do for you next time you guest on that show.
I would love to hear that.
Ben Hosley, if you're listening.
You kind of hear and watch it because it has the theremin.
There's so many good theremin stories. One day, we'll just do a theremin cast.
Yeah, we'll have Jordan on. In conclusion, I think one of my favorite things that I saw, so there's this area in Durham called the American Tobacco Campus. It's this old tobacco warehouse that's been turned into this public space with like a basketball court. It's where the public radio station is. It's where the Full Frame Documentary Film Festival happens. I haven't been in town for it yet, but I will be next year. And there's this big open grassy area that's underneath a water tower with the Lucky Strike logo on it, which kind of tells you about the history of this town. And on Sunday afternoon, it was this beautiful day, and there were all these people sitting in the grass, like next to this river. And there were people in this little band shell underneath the Lucky Strike water tower playing the weirdest, craziest electronic music you've ever heard. And it was just part of outdoor life experience in Durham. And I really just love that that became part of the fabric of the city for a couple days. So well done, Moog Fest. I am maybe Durham's newest resident, and I applaud you.
Now,
yeah, looks like Durham, sounds like Tron.
Yeah. Now,
now go listen to Parliament Funkadelic and learn.
Parliament Funkadelic was here too.
Yeah, they're Afrofuturist.
Well, all right. So I'd heard of Parliament Funkadelic, so I got something going
you're
on.
You're getting there.
So high roaded 1-to-1 as we go into segment 3.
All right, for segment 3, well, it should be clear, just before segment 3, Dave told me that he was ready to go for my throat, so here we go.
People love it when we fight on the show.
We're not going to fight, it's going to be hugs and kisses. So, this weekend, Alien Covenant came out and reigned somewhat supreme. It was number one at the box office, even though I don't think it made a ton of money, like $35 million or something, which was probably a huge disappointment for a movie of that scale. We talked a little about it on the last podcast. David and I dug the hell out of it. Dave, I don't know if you had seen it yet, so we should definitely get your opinion on that in 1 second. But the big thing for me coming out of the movie was hearing a lot of people hate this movie, let's be clear. And I'm sure people listening to this hate Alien Covenant if they went to see it this weekend, because it's so weird. I mean, if you love the original Alien movie, you will probably not like what you get in Alien Covenant. It is not about xenomorphs attacking people. It's not even about them stalking people, really. There's some of that at the end of the movie. But for the most part, this is a Prometheus sequel, big ideas and baroque acting. It's Michael Fassbender leading the way. I mean, this is not really a quote-unquote alien movie. But then what is, would be my question to everyone. Like, is there such thing as an alien movie? Our friend Jermaine Lussier over at IO9 wrote an article that basically summed up that, you know, they shouldn't have made any more sequels to Alien after Aliens, because that's when, I guess, good ideas stopped. But that doesn't make any sense. And I love Jermaine. But for me, that doesn't make a lot of sense, because Aliens is nothing like Alien. If you went into Aliens, you would say, this is not an alien movie. This is not shadowy, stalking aliens. It's not a horror movie. It's an action movie. It's totally different. So why would you stop making sequels to that original idea when the original concept has no definition? There's no such thing as an alien movie. And it's kind of the best case sequel scenario. We're complaining about, you know, like churning out Marvel movies or something, or half-baked sequels. I haven't seen the new Pirates of the Caribbean yet, but I've heard some wacky things that it's a basically regurgitation and a lot of what you've come to love, maybe, of the Pirates of the Caribbean movies. You know, it's just another sequel, and it seems obvious about how to do it. But for Alien, anything is possible, because there's no such thing as an alien movie. Now, Dave, why would you stop making alien movies? Alien Covenant is a great alien sequel because it's totally different. It's just off the wall, and there's no definition. Like, it can't defy mythology, and it can't defy tone, because there is no such thing as an alien tone. And that's what makes Alien a great property to sequelize, because you can do anything with it as long as it has a xenomorph and someone with a little gusto.
I mean, I think it goes slightly beyond that to the hubris of man causes a bureaucracy to inflict evolutionary horror upon a group of people, of which a female rises to the occasion. I think that's what makes an alien movie. But what you're talking about is something more like what they're doing with Cloverfield now, where it's like, this is a Cloverfield movie because we added a scene onto this original sci-fi script and to get like more butts in the seats. What I like about Alien Covenant, or what I liked when I saw it, is we're moving into this period where if you accept that if something is popular enough, that its continuation will be an inevitability for the near future, which encompasses tons of stuff right now, then all rules are off the table, as long as you deliver on even what partially your franchise or your license is supposed to be. But I think the wild variance in between that means there's actually fewer rules now for what would be a sequel in terms of what we thought a blockbuster sequel was in the 1980s, which was essentially, let's do the first movie again because people just want more. Now that it's inevitable we're going to get more, it's opening it up to have more crazy variants for what that is and still be trying to tell us. I mean, something like the Marvel Cinematic Universe, it's like Doctor Strange and Guardians of the Galaxy and Captain America. They make references to each other and say that they're all in the same universe, but they're all vastly different types of movies. And we just take it on face value because the franchise is telling you they're in the same franchise.
We haven't transcended the moment where people, where the studios would deliver a movie that's exactly like the last one, because there's an actual demand for that, right? If you're saying that Alien Covenant is bad because it has nothing in common with other Alien movies, then what you're saying is you want another Alien movie that's exactly the same. You want a sequel because you like the franchise, you like the idea, but you also don't want it to defy whatever in your mind, you know, is the definition of that sequel. Well, people still want something connecting to the old. They want to feel what they did the first time, even if on the surface they're saying more original ideas or take a big departure, take a big risk. There's something about a sequel that needs to feel comforting and familiar for it to be successful. So Katie, I ask you, what does it mean for a movie to be sequelable, or what does a sequel need to do? And does it seems lost in limbo. It seems like a lose-lose.
I mean, I really go back and forth because the Cloverfield example is really interesting because I feel like it's such a smart way to get original storytelling out there. But I don't think that any of that qualifies as a sequel. Like the idea of it being in a cinematic universe is kind of irrelevant, which I think is what made 10 Cloverfield Lane good, is that it was kind of using this fig leaf of a cinematic universe and telling the story that it wanted to tell.
And then the Reddit kids could go off and figure out if it's an actual sequel by framing.
If they want to do that, and then I can enjoy the movie on its own, then I feel like everybody wins.
What's the difference between that, putting Cloverfield in the title of a non-Cloverfield movie, and putting Alien on the front of Covenant?
Well, that there's an actual xenomorph alien in it, and there's Wayland Co., and there's fragments of the past movies that surface here, literally.
So the movie that I was thinking about in terms of what can be sequelized and what can't is Blade Runner or Blade Runner 2049. I get very confused between the two Ridley Scott movies that are coming out with sequels very late and which one Ridley Scott actually directed. Anyway, that to me feels like the ultimate example of something that cannot have a sequel. And I watched the trailer. It looks beautiful. God bless Roger Deakins. But I still cannot fathom how that movie can have a sequel. Am I crazy?
I feel like the world can be revisited, but
yeah,
with Harrison Ford in it.
No,
that's the problem. Is that including Deckard closes off part of the world, and that's definitely something that you don't want a sequel to do. Both as like satisfying story and as a tool for more sequels. It seems weird to be like, we're going to answer whether or not he was a replicant.
Yeah.
By having him appear.
Yeah. Really don't want to see that.
That was the Tron Legacy problem too, right? Like there was no reason Tron Legacy needed to continue the story of Tron. No one knew it. Jeff Bridges, not a big enough star that he needed to be in the movie.
Most of Tron Legacy doesn't. Like that's the movie that has a genocide happen in like a talking over dinner period where it's like, well, son, here's what happened. But like there's a whole Tron world that they were planning to flesh out. They just didn't get there fast enough because they thought they needed this transition step. But maybe if it was, you know, a new Tron movie was made now, we could get plopped down in the middle of something.
They're trying, right? Jared Leto is
yeah,
might be in it.
Sure. Well, let me know when The Crow's in production, too.
I mean, I want to sit here and be like, the best way to make a sequel is to make the story that you want to make within this universe and kind of leave everything that came before aside. But then I think about how much I love The Force Awakens and how much it really is indebted to everything that happened in the previous movies. And so maybe it's just make a sequel of movies I like and then everything else leave it alone. That is a very hot take.
But is Force Awakens indebted to the past? Does it need, for me, what kind of weighs it down is like Harrison Ford again and Princess Leia and Luke at the end, I guess. I mean,
says Patches.
The most joyful moment in the movie is when you see the Millennium Falcon for the first time.
Yeah, but you could do that without any of the original characters.
What? Are you kidding me? Maybe you can do it without the original characters, but the Millennium Falcon is a character in this context.
Right.
So, I don't. It's Star Wars is interesting and Marvel is interesting because they're attempting to create a situation where they could do endless sequels instead of having to yank a sequel out of something that wasn't intended to be a sequel, which actually feels like better. Like, there's a sort of way that, like, the Resident Evil franchise tries to chain together with false cliffhangers and then immediately has to explain or undo at the beginning of the next movie. That's, like, really annoying. And so it's like, I'm glad that we got out of that period, like, I guess the pre-Avengers period, where we didn't know there was going to be a continuation, so they just tried to vault it up, like, please come back to us in the last 5 minutes of the movie. But I think, like, I don't know, I think that still just frees you up to just put it yourself in, like, a crazy situation and have a recognizable character or institution show up halfway through your otherwise new world investigation. But I wonder how, like, vague it could be. Like, I pitched this several times about how, like, if a TV series gets bad, you just have them find a Dharma station at the end of season two and just pivot it into a lost sequel series. Because I feel like...
Someone is going to do it eventually. There's enough television that someone will do this.
Wait, yeah, we'll so do a like, lost show?
A backdoor lost show.
James I actually think before. That J.J. Abrams will do a lost movie that you don't know is a lost movie. I don't know why this has been on my mind, but that's it just seems inevitable that J.J. Abrams will loop Lost into something else he's doing.
Well, this has been on your mind because it's all like Twin Peaks. I was saying, like, after I saw Alien Covenant, there needs to be... a category, or it needs to be like a word for a movie that on its own isn't good, but once viewed in the grand view of the franchise, is like basically essential.
Ugh.
I think that's, you know, Fire Walk With Me and Prometheus, where it's like, I'm not necessarily going to sit down and that's going to be the only part of Alien or the only part of Twin Peaks that I revisit. But if I'm doing a complete thing, those two things seem like cornerstone to understanding why the franchise or why the story is the way that
it is. That's so funny because Prometheus is not that way for me at all. Like, it doesn't really tie back to the Alien franchise. I'm not seeing it in the context of the Alien franchise. I'm seeing something familiar as the bedrock of it because I know what these aliens do and I know what it means when these spores get in someone's eye or... you know, when a chest burster pops out of their body, I know what's going to happen. And that is scary and visceral because now you've created anticipation through history, through cinematic history. But I'm not watching Prometheus being like, how is it going to tie back to the original movie? And that seems distracting to what's actually really fun about Prometheus. I am a pro Prometheus person, by the way, which is the crazy swings by Ridley Scott to talk about religion and creation and androids versus man. And none of this has to do with the Alien franchise. It's just bending it in a new way and taking advantage of what you know about some of its more visceral elements.
Right, but it allows it to be... like, Prometheus is going to be the thing that allows it to pivot because now every time the alien's on screen, even if you rewatch retroactively, it can prick those actual questions out of your mind, whether or not the movie contains it. So, like, Alien Resurrection is also about genetically screwing with the alien, but it doesn't become a human-to-human Ouroboros eating tail thing until Alien like Covenant. So it's like by continuing on in this weird pivot franchise that's all about Michael Fassbender, we're going to reinform these other movies that function as singular good horror action, you know, claustrophobic movies. And now it's like crazy sci-fi creationism ideas. I'm into the pivot, but that pivot doesn't work if you take out Prometheus now because Covenant is pushing from Prometheus towards Alien.
Does any of this feel like it affects aliens?
Yeah, because they're just cutting the queen out, sort of. Like, David somehow ends up with an egg with a facehugger in it, but not. We don't see any evidence of there being a queen, which is basically the, you know, what James Cameron contributed to the franchise.
But couldn't he genetically engineer one? I mean, not to get in the weeds.
I mean, probably.
None of this will impact the way I feel about Aliens next time I watch it.
No.
Oh, yeah. Aliens is... No.
It's safe.
Yeah. I think we're still missing an insectoid species because we're missing some of those behaviors. But either here nor there, I like the idea that I don't know. Maybe I don't like the idea. The more I think about it, I'm like, if something does have to be a pivot movie that is bad out of context, then that means that I'm going to have to just put up with bad movies and hope that the next one's better. But I guess there's no other option. What is my other option? To actively root against franchises I like because heaven forbid they get bad in the future?
I mean, that's the thing. The resistance to sequels seems silly to me because you want them to take a risk and you want to see more of what people can do with this concept. And it's not going to defile the original. And I'd rather see Ridley Scott play with this iconography and this mythology and bend it to his will. But my question is, do you guys have... Are there sequels that are almost exactly the same as the original movie that are really good or that are totally enjoyable?
I mean, do-over. I guess Back to the Future 2 is kind of a literal version of that, but not really. Like, it does a lot of different stuff, but it literally does over the first movie.
Right, but like that's part of the joke too, right? That you're repeating.
Yeah, but beats. I mean, part of its satisfaction is seeing this. I don't know. It's a tough question.
I was thinking of think. Home
I like
Alone
the 2. Idea.
Lost in New York. Home Alone 2 is a good example.
Totally enjoyable movie, I think, the last time I watched it, 10 years ago. Except Donald Trump's in it, so I don't
know. He has solid.
But in Home Alone 2, he throws a pipe at Marv. So you got that one. You got that going.
I mean, don't the Die Hard movies have this power?
Yeah, Die Hard. I mean, I think of Die Hard movies as kind of what the Marvel movies within their own franchises have done, like Iron Man, Iron Man 2, Iron Man 3. Iron Man 2 is a piece of shit, but Iron Man 3 is a fun diversion and totally changes up how these movies are supposed to work, is in on its own joke, is still just laying down the exact same action beats over and over and over again and riding the charisma of the main hero. And Die Hard, clearly one of the best action movies of all time. Die Hard 3, really good action movie that's almost the same thing, except now he has a buddy and it's in New York and filmed in real New York locations, which is madness. I mean, the
I have a good one
in Central Park is out of this world. But yeah, it's not different, right? You're just it's bigger stakes, and that's what happened to Die Hard. It blew up and it got bigger and bigger, and then Len Wiseman took over. Jesus.
Jurassic Park franchise.
Wait, really?
One thing. Super enjoyable, but it's one thing over and over again.
Well, Jurassic Park,
I feel like that's the cautionary tale, I think.
The Lost World has moments, but it's not... It never feels like a cohesive movie to me. I never think of that as a sweeping movie like Jurassic Park. There's a lot of, you know, the stampede scene is really cool, and then you get to the T-Rex stuff, and that's totally repetitive. And then they bring it to San Francisco, and that's its own thing. But it's,
well, you skipped
so
over the raptor stuff, which is... okay when it's in the weeds.
What are the
that
raptors
fun at
do
the time.
In Lost World?
They chase everybody into a building where Ian Malcolm's daughter uses gymnastics kick them out.
How could I forget? She swings.
How could you forget?
I don't know. I mean
what
there was
about
a moment...
what about like Spider-Man 2?
But these superhero movies are always going to imitate themselves because the heroes and the powers have their own limitations. And the scenario, like, Spider-Man is trapped in New York. That should have been the real premise of the movie. He can't escape New York! But
there's a movie about that, I think, about escaping New York.
Oh, I would have loved a Snake Pilskin? Pilskin?
Pilskin. Snake Pilskin.
Roger? A snake in Spider-Man movie. That would have been good. But,
you know what's a good example of this? And it's a shame Dave's not here. The Mission Impossible movies.
Wait, Dave is here.
David, sorry.
David. David, yeah, he's the MI3.
Oh.
And not that MI3 is bad, but David likes it more than I do.
But those movies have a formula, they repeat it. I mean, the Fast and Furious movies are like this too, and they're totally enjoyable.
Yeah, it always made me wonder what the second one got so wrong in the fact that other Mission Impossibles have been enjoyable, but the second one isn't.
Well, they weren't about the mission. They were trying to turn Tom Cruise. I mean, reminds me more of how the Alien movies have deviated with both using the same elements in each movie, kind of, and then pushing genre or pushing conceit. And like Mission Impossible 2 is going to be a John Woo gun-fu movie starring a hyper-masculine hero riding his butt, like his motorcycle's hair blowing in the wind, slow-mo pigeons. And it's just good concept for John Woo. We've seen it tested in other movies, but it doesn't apply to this, to Tom Cruise, for Mission Impossible, for the vibe set up by the first movie. And none of the other movies replicate what Mission Impossible, Brian De Palma's version, did, which is tense, and it's a thriller, and there's a MacGuffin, and there's a big action scene at the end, but that's at the very, very end. And the infiltration scene at the where he's, you know, lowers down at the computer, one-of-a-kind sequence, but it's like a heist, and you don't... There's elements of that that are bigger now in these more action-oriented movies, but even Go to Call doesn't feel... I still call it Go to Call. Ghost Protocol doesn't feel like Rogue Nation to me, right? There's still tweaks. There's still director movies. I think that's a big thing these days, and we'll talk about it more and more as the malaise of blockbusterdom continues to congeal, which is like director movies like Alien Covenant, which is a swing for the fences move from Ridley Scott, and Marvel movies, which are producer movies that are part of a larger corporate machine. And that's not necessarily a bad thing because we enjoy some of them and maybe not others, but like there's a big difference there. And I think that's the key element of sequels.
I mean, yeah, I like Alien Covenant for what it is, but I'm also sad that we've lost this franchise to Ridley Scott, who is going to have a singular vision for it, because I always sort of enjoyed the messiness of let's put a promising young director on an alien movie and see what comes out of him. And I'm kind of sad that, you know, like, not that Neil Blomkamp's especially right. young, but that he's going to miss out on Alien 5 just because Fox doesn't want to, you know, poison the water while Ridley Scott's driving the ship.
I mean, one day you might. Ridley Scott is not a young man, so it might, I imagine the Alien franchise will outlive him.
He is super old.
Sure, but it was pure up through Alien versus Predator Requiem. Every movie had like a different crazy, like, let's get these guys guys a shot. And now it's like, and then back to Ridley Scott.
I mean, it didn't necessarily work out well for David Fincher, so.
That's true.
Well, that's our conversation about sequels. We've gone, we're no longer in the period of time where we would get a movie or a sequel to like Stakeout, which is called Another Stakeout. We'll never get another sequel, which is really sad. Another Iron Man.
I mean, but now we've evolved to F8, meaning not only the eighth Fast movie, but Fate. So I feel like history is bending towards progress.
Yeah, and maybe we'll get Captain America High Noon at Mega Mountain one day, but until then, sequels. Bring on more sequels. I'm fine with that. I'm level. I'm ready.
Oh, God. I don't know what the next terrible sequel. Well, Pirates 5. That's what you get.
Yeah. No! Arg!
The rest of the summer.
That does it for this week's Fighting in the War Room. We'll be back next week. David should be back, unless he just decides to stay in Cannes, which who could blame him? But in the meantime, tell the people who you are.
I am Matt Patches, editor, Thrillist.com. I'm on Twitter at Mr. Patches. Tonight I'm broadcasting from the apartment formerly known as Katie's apartment. But I know.
Hey! Oh yeah, we haven't told listeners that. You live in my old apartment.
I do. You moved to Durham, and I moved into your house. And now I'm where you used to podcast. I feel the energy. I'm now the glue. No, speaking of glue, fightinginthewarroom.com is our real glue where you can listen to episodes and you can share them and you can leave comments like what you think about Alien Covenant. I'm sure there are serious opinions. So, fightinginthewarroom.com.
And I'm Dave Gonzalez. Spell my first name, D-A-7-E. That's also my Twitter handle. And you can find the entire podcast on Facebook at facebook.com, Fighting in the War Room. And, of course, Storm of Spoilers is going back to what we do best, which is Game of Thrones this week. So make sure to go, like Patches said, to fightinginthewarroom.com and check out all the podcasts there. Maybe even some back podcasts. So many good podcasts, fightinginthewarroom.com.
I'm Katie Rich. You can find me at vanityfair.com, where I write sometimes, and I'm on the Little Gold Man podcast, just in case you're looking for me. You can find me on Twitter at Katie Rich, KateyRich. And we're all on Twitter at FITWR, where you can talk to us and harass us. No, don't harass us. Just tease us lightly. But maybe just answer this week's lightning round question, which was...
In honor of Pirates of the Caribbean, Dead Men Tell No Tales, what's the most regrettable performance by an Oscar winner?
Thank you for listening, and we'll be back talking to you next week.
On the table, the mouths are